I'd like to welcome Mary Sojourner. She's an author, teacher, activist, and former NPR commentator. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Now, you are a writer, and I thought that maybe we could start with a reading from one of your books called Bone Light. Would you like to do that?
I'd love to do that. I'll preface it by saying that I moved to Flagstaff, Arizona in 1985. I had read Edward Abbey, and it was time for me to leave the Northeast and to come here. And I came with the intention to write and to fight for the earth. And Opening was written, oh my gosh, probably 10 or 15 years later, when I had waked to the fact that the Southwest was under attack primarily from development. So I will read. Opening. To write about the new Southwest is to write about hunger and greed, emptiness and searing beauty. To write about the new Southwest is to be humbled again and again. I write about hunger because I am perpetually hungry. I write about greed because I always want more. I write about emptiness because I too often feel empty. And that makes me kin to frantic developers, builders, hustlers, card sharks, slot hogs, and billionaires, one of whom has said, I am insatiable for land. I can't ever own enough. I write about beauty because in doubting mine, I have lost it, and I cannot bear to see the beauty of this Western earth lost to bad faith. I am humbled because I have limped into the throat of the Turtle Mountains, paddled on the San Juan River in the noon twilight of a solar eclipse, been swallowed and spit out by Rapid 24 and a half on the Colorado River, and stood helpless above an unnamed wetland valley watching bulldozers rip it apart.
And that's, we're talking to Mary Sojourner. I'm really struck in this and in all of your work by the combination of real humility and also righteous anger that fuels the activism in your work.
It's a striking observation. At this moment, I'm in the strange kind of crazy quilt of leaving Flagstaff. In fact, in 4 days, I'll be moving to a little Mojave desert town, which shall not be named to protect the innocent.
Right.
And I would have told you when I wrote Opening that I understood humility, but I think in the last probably 4 to 5 years, as I've become more and more solidly aware of the changes going on in Flagstaff, in the American culture, in the publishing industry, and in my own body as I age, humility, humbleness has taken on a new dimension. Righteous anger is stronger than it ever was.
Tell us more about your experience in Flagstaff. When did you move there?
I arrived in Flagstaff on January 4th, 1985, and there were about between 34 and 35,000 people in the town. Much of the forested areas, it's mostly ponderosa pine, around the town have now been developed into Walmarts and shopping malls and very expensive housing. We have two or three gated golf developments, and we are, of course, dealing with the same thing that's happening all over the country, and that property isn't selling, and that I've been gratified to see that investment properties that people made and never lived in are the gated development south of me. During the winter, 85% of the units stand empty, and most of the time, there's nobody living in any of these huge mansions. So the change, we now have over 70,000 people, and we have tons of people who come here and use this as a playground but don't have any real commitment to what they're playing in.
Gee, it sounds like another town I know.
It sounds like 4 million towns you know. Welcome to the new Southwest, which is not so new anymore.
Well, that term, the New West or the New Southwest, what does it mean? What does it refer to?
When I use it?
Yeah.
It means that the West no longer actually exists, despite people who trundle in here and buy cowboy hats and cowboy boots and chic little cowgirl outfits. For me, the New Southwest is a place that could be the microcosm of the more general using up of the planet. And I, you know, want to talk a little bit about how writing has fit into this, because, you know, after I read Aunt Abby, I initially came out here to work on issues like mining and logging and learned very rapidly. A good friend of mine, a guy named Dan Daggett, said to me 20 years ago, the day's going to come when what you're going to be furious about is development and off-road vehicle use. And that has evolved. You know, that has happened. Initially for me, writing, and this is many, many years ago, was a way to pour out conflicts and sorrow and anger and confusion onto a piece of paper and release it really from my heart and my mind. I was the divorced mother of three kids and raised them completely by myself with no support and worked full time and was going to school. This is, oh my gosh, this is 33 years ago. And the only way I made it through a lot of the days and was able to sleep at night is to use a journal, to use a pen, and to get my hand moving. The emotional release doesn't work quite as well for me on a computer, but it does work in a journal. I'd always known I wanted to be a writer. When I was a little girl, reading saved my life. I grew up in a home with a bipolar mom who was always trying to kill herself and not succeeding, and a kind of old-fashioned patriarchal dad who was hanging on the best he could. And reading allowed me to have sanity. Reading allowed me to keep going forward. So when I had waked up to the fact that the West was under assault, it was clear to me that I needed to take that more personal writing and move it out into defense of this astonishing place. And I'm not talking about pretty landscape. I'm talking about the way the horned toad and the desert and a fly and intermittent rain, you know, and the saguaro and the lunar moth, how all of that weaves together. That we are a tiny part of that. We are not the top of the food chain. And how we all live together in that web, it became very clear to me that if I never did anything, I moved out here when I was 45. If I never did anything for the rest of my life but to write in gratitude to the place I had come to live in, that would be enough. And there have been lots of other stuff. I mean, I've been arrested in defensive places and, you know, picketed big box bookstores, Barnes & Noble specifically, in defense of independent bookstores. But it the writing is the lifeline for me.
We're talking to Mary Sojourner. One thing that I always wonder about is that writers like you, who write so beautifully and with so much heart, the people who read that work tend to be other people with a whole lot of heart and not the people whose hearts need to be opened in a way.
I learned a long time ago, I am, among other things, a recovering lover of alcoholics and drug addicts, and through a 12-step program, I learned a long time ago that I can't change anybody else.
Yeah.
And I have been in many, many, many meetings with the people who are very clearly the other side. And despite calls for compromise and cooperation, what I learned in those meetings is that their notion of compromise was that they would get what they want and we would go away. And there are, you know, there are processes and phenomena that work beautifully. I mean, there are land conservancies and land trusts that are able to to acquire land by buying it from people or setting up conservation easements, and the developer, the landowner, gets their money and they go away. But in trying to effect compromise with, for instance, a developer here who wanted to put a gated golf mansion thingy around a landlocked wetland, one of the few wetlands in Arizona that's in a volcano crater. And what we found is that it was impossible. What he wanted was everything. And I will never forget his environmental consultant saying, hey, you have to face it, Mary. Here's what we do. We nuke and we mitigate. I will never forget that meeting. And I was sitting in the meeting and I thought, holy cow, we are different subspecies of the same species. We don't speak the same language. We don't operate from the same notion of the planet. At one point, the developer said, well, this little blue marble spinning in space. And I said to him, excuse me, not a blue marble. That's a cliche. What the planet is a web of interdependent life, water, rock, and light. And he just looked at me blankly. There's an essay in my essay collection, Bone Light, that talks about that lunch that we had. So I have quite given up. I don't believe that it's possible to crack those people's hearts. And where I am at this point, and I'm sure you know and your listeners know, that we are in dire, dire straits on this planet. I just read an article about an Antarctic ice shelf about to break off and bats dying from diseases in New York State that are pollution and climate change related. I mean, it just escalates. The honeybees are leaving. I could go on and on and on. Time is short. And so what I like to do now, and I do it in my teaching conscientiously and intensely, is I'm very interested in working with people whose hearts already are a bit broken, or people whose hearts are darn near blown, just smashed, because I think we need to take care of each other at this point. Those of us who, for whatever reason, are stewards for community and for the land and for diversity, and those words have been so overused, but we're overusing them because they are the truth. They're absolutely the truth. We are desperate for diversity. We're desperate for love for the planet, and we're desperate for community. So when I teach and when I read, my intention is to give to what some people would call the choir or people on the edge of the choir. That's where I believe it's critical at this stage for me to work. My own heart is broken. I'm leaving Flagstaff in part because my heart is broken. And because I carry a broken heart, I think it allows me to work with empathy, with compassion, and as a pretty fine-honed blade with people who want to stay alive and who want to make a difference.
Historically, people have responded to catastrophe, and what we're trying to do now is something that's very different, namely to avert catastrophe, because once catastrophe comes, a lot of things will be irrecoverable, unrecoverable.
I think that what is critical to face is it isn't that the catastrophe is coming. It's here. If you doubt that, you could be one of those bats that's covered with some eerie fungus that they think is associated with global warming. You could be the last salmon trying to swim up the Sacramento River because all the other salmon are gone. You could try being a person who came across the border between Mexico and the United States without the proper papers and is working 16 hours a day for very little money, terrified all the time that they're going to be arrested and taken back. And of course, very often they're working those hours in the gardens and the empty mansions of the people who have a whole lot of money. The catastrophe is here. And I think it's critical that we as adults, and I think part of the dilemma in America is because of the comfort that so many of us, middle class, upper middle class, intellectual, whatever term you want to use, the comfort we live in, we are allowed to imagine that the catastrophe is not here. The catastrophe is here. You know, I was blessed a year ago to hear a very deep gentleman from a Native American tribe speak to a small group of us and tell us that the shift from the existing world to the next world is imminent. And in my belief, we're in it. So we are, at this moment, watching the weather blow into New Orleans. We're in it.
And still, so many of us have our central heating and warm water still working, and there's still food in the supermarkets. And so there's this sense that everything's the same as it was in 1970.
Well, that's an interesting statement. So who is us? Who are we?
Well, I'm speaking personally.
Precisely. And in global terms, we are a tiny segment of the population.
That's right.
There's a tendency on the part of corporate media and the more general media to always be talking about we and us. I mean, one of my news sources is the New York Times Online, and they're always talking about we and us. And that we and us is a sliver of the human species. I'm very interested, and I do this in my writing. I do it at a... I started out doing it at a level specific to women. You know, I'd begun to notice that in movies and in magazines and in stories and fiction, so often the woman was tall and slender and beautiful. She was definitely beautiful, no matter what. She was beautiful. And she was most often young. And I get really irritated with that. So in my fiction, my heroines tend to be 45, 50 and older. Many of them are big women. Many of them are plain. I directly challenge who this we is. Who's the heroine? Who's this we? And because I grew up in a farm town, on a farm. My father was a teacher. Because of my mother's bipolar condition, which nobody understood at the time, we were poor. We were poorer than everybody else around us. And the town was taken over by developers to put in essentially bedroom communities for Kodak and Xerox. And as that happened, the socioeconomic condition of my friends, of the homes, of everything, altered, and it became essentially upper middle class white. I watched hills leveled, creeks wiped out, meadows destroyed, woodlands chopped down. And then I watched the socioeconomic diversity of this little town, and I wouldn't have said those words back then, but I watched it come apart. And early on, I could fake my way, because I'm a chameleon, I could fake my way with the upper middle class kids. I mean, I could say what was necessary, but I was always watching, and I was always observing, and I always knew, thanks to my mom, who taught me about racism, who taught me about economic gaps, who taught me basic, not liberal politics, but really radical politics. Because of her teaching, and because my father was a working class guy who would say to me repeatedly, don't ever think you're better than the other kids because you're going to go to college. Those kids in my secretarial classes, those boys in the shop, they're going to work their butts off. And you're not better. And because of that grounding, I've never lost my identity. And I've certainly never, I live on about $900 a month. So,
right.
And that includes my Social Security. So I am intellectually, I'm we. Intellectually, I'm us. A lot of my friends are. But at the level of still scrabbling to stay alive, I'm not us, and I'm not them, and I know what it is to be marginalized. And if you don't know what it is to be marginalized, get older, be single, and don't have a whole lot of money. One of my favorite things to do is, you know, I teach at writing conferences and go to book festivals, and I love to go in my ordinary clothes, which are, you know, cargo pants and something I bought at Goodwill, and you know, the one thing I'll spend money on is good shoes, because I'm going to be able to walk, because I hike and I walk. And I love to go to a conference in that kind of clothing and be completely ignored, totally ignored, until somebody says, "Aren't you Mary Sojourner?" And everything changes.
Right.
So I love that kind of guerrilla politics and guerrilla theater. And I think that's, all of this is a piece of why I love teaching and working with people who come into writing circles saying, theoretically, I have a life of privilege, but I can feel that I'm starving to death. I'm here in this circle to start to understand how to better feed myself.
Yeah.
And I guess in my perspective, the more that pen moves and the more people can write into that emptiness or that hunger, the more there's the possibility of suddenly seeing through our great good luck to live in America and to have what we have. I mean, I've been, you know, I eat Thai food once a week. Come on. You know, I drive a vehicle. But once you can get into that ache, and I think it's an ache for connection with all the rest of the planet, not just humans, but with the very planet that feeds us and clothes us and without which we would not exist. I think once you can touch that emptiness, then at least in the short term, we're going to start taking better care of ourselves and better care of each other and better care of the ground we move over.
I was thinking about what you were saying one day when I was watching the prairie dogs that live in the park outside of my house. And I was thinking about how when I go home, that's my home and I feel safe there. And how the prairie dogs, it's exactly the same for them. That's their home. And we treat them like it's not their home. We treat them like everything is our potential home and they just have to move. And suddenly the prairie dogs and all refugees and me potentially and everybody potentially were all of a piece. And I was thinking that's sort of when you start to realize that we actually includes not only all people but all these animals as well, everything shifts and it becomes boundaries get blurred and definitions start to change.
Thank goodness, because that's reality. And that's what was understood by people, and I'm not romanticizing or glorifying, you know, living dependent on in connection with the earth. I just finished a really wonderful novel by a woman named Connie Willis called Doomsday Book. And in it, a young woman is sent back into the past, and they think they're sending her to 1320, but she ends up in 1348 when the Black Plague is almost in the village that she ends up in. And I got to just be with her in this village, because she's a wonderful writer, and be in the village and see how tiny we are and how hooked in we are to everything else, you know, to the plague, to animals, to each other. And I love that you say that, and you are blessed to have had that experience. You're also cursed, because the Catholic theologian Thomas Berry has said that some of us are nerve endings for the earth. And once you make that connect, it's going to be harder and harder to be comfortable. But, you know, we're probably the first 3 or 4 decades of people to believe that we had a right to be comfortable. That's not the nature of being a living organism on the planet.
Right.
It's not guaranteed comfort. I'm so glad you had that experience. I just will toss in a quick prairie dog story. There is now a huge hulking corporate hotel on the south end of Flagstaff where there used to be a prairie dog colony, their village. And I got stuck at a traffic light there. And I watched those prairie dogs mess with a cat. It was an orange tabby cat, and he was hunting prairie dogs. And the prairie dogs would pop up out of their home, make a squeaking noise, and he would start moving toward the prairie dog that had made a noise. it would then drop back down into the colony, and another prairie dog on the opposite side of the circle would pop up. And they had the cat finally just shook its head. He was dizzy from the game they were playing with him. He shook his head, and he just slunk away. It was so you're part of that, girl.
You know, there's another interesting paradox that I was thinking about that reading your work, and that is that we who love the West, the Southwest, love the silence and the nonverbal world around us. It's not all about conversations. It's not all about verbalizing everything. And then at the same time, especially you who are writing, you want to name things. You want to know the name of the flower and of the bird. What does it give you to do that naming and also not to do it?
Indeed. And we want, in my case, because I'm ignorantly only speak one language, I want to name that. I want to know the name of something in English or in Latin, in human. And there are those precious moments, and it usually involves, and it's so funny because as I'm talking to you, I can hear a plane going overhead from the airport. I live a little bit south of the airport. I'd be sitting on my back porch. I'm sorry, it's a helicopter. I'd be sitting on the back porch, but I was pretty sure that the air noise would get in the way of the interview. You know, there are these precious moments, and part of why I'm moving to the Mojave is because it's quiet. And what will happen for me, and this may be true for other of your listeners, and boy, with my writing students, this is definitely true. The initial experience of sitting and doing nothing and hearing nothing for me is always unsettling to the point of my being terrified. You know, I'll start to think, oh my God, I'm going crazy. And if I sit through the fear, then there are no words for what happens. I'm just there. And I can talk about it now, but the combination of the warmth on my face and the scent of creosote and then there are sounds you hear, especially in the desert. You hear the rattling of dry branches. But I'm just there, and it never lasts for very long because the words will kick back in. And part of that's because I'm a writer, because I'll be there and I'll go, oh, copper light on the mesquite.
Right.
That's fine. I signed on a long time ago to do this work, but that is the moment of knowing without words that you're a prairie dog, and knowing without words that you're a creosote bush, and knowing without words that you're the way the dawn comes up behind a desert mountain. We're very, very lucky. And when I teach, I'll ask my students, I don't want to give anything away because I'm going to be teaching in Santa Fe, and I prefer to surprise people. Let's just say I work doing nothing into the actual writing workshop. And, you know, I'm so blessed because people who come to my classes and come to the writing circles, I truly believe that we're on a path to intersect with each other. So they're hungry, they're starving for what we do in the classes. And they're honest, and so people, you know, we'll do 5 minutes of doing nothing, and then people write about it, and then they read what they've written, and they're so honest about their discomfort. And lest I sound like I'm, you know, some adept, some meditation adept, every single time I start to get too busy, when I move back from the busyness to go back into doing nothing so I can get to my writing, I'm hugely uncomfortable. It never gets easier. I think the epidemic of busy, busy, busy that we're seeing in our culture at this point, especially among us, you know, the white middle class, upper middle class people, I think that busyness is a way to attempt to outrun our own inner discomfort, and then the discomfort of looking at what's happening to the planet. And boy, to slow down and just be with that, that's a son of a gun.
There's that, but there's also the demand of productivity that keeps us so busy.
You know what? I think that's a con. I think that the demands of productivity, well, oh my God, there's a million scenarios with this. Suppose somebody starts to feel empty. So they buy something new, or they take on a new responsibility, or they go into this mega managing of their children, or they go into mega managing of their beloved dog. You know, they go into mega managing of their partner, and then they take on something else, and then they take on something else, and they got to be busy, productive, and busy, and busy, and productive. And I'm curious about what happens when one experiences that discomfort of the emptiness, and instead of filling that space, is just with it. And when I do the silence and the doing nothing work with my students, I ask them not to meditate, because meditating involves doing something.
Right.
I'm asking them to just be, to just clear. And I ask them to forget. I'm not at all devaluing meditation. I say a mantra every single morning. I do repetitions of a mantra. And I think I'll just tuck the mantra in, because it came to me right after 9/11, and I was reading an exquisite book called Skull Mantra, yeah, by Elliot Patterson. It's a beautiful book on the occupation of Tibet, and it's a book that, if we look at what's happening right now, the book is an astonishing education in that. So I'm reading this book about occupied Tibet. 9/11 has occurred. I'm about 4 days post 9/11. And this prayer comes to me, and it's for the furthering of all sentient beings and the protection of earth, air, and water. And I do a bunch of repetitions of it in the morning. So meditation to me is valuable, hugely valuable. There's a great moment in one of Patterson's books where a monk who's being herded along a trail in a Chinese work gang, they're punishing the Tibetans, stops to pick up an inscribed stone from a temple that the Chinese have destroyed and sets it in place, and he gets beaten for it. And his buddy, who is actually a Chinese, who has been put in the work camp for not being a good Chinese, whatever their political thing is at this point. I don't think it's communism, it's something else. Anyhow, his friend says to him, Lokesh, why did you do that? You got beaten. And Lokesh, the monk, says, well, that could have been the prayer that saves the world. So I want to drop back to being able to tolerate emptiness, being able to follow emptiness through to what is inevitably there, which is a thread of connection. And I don't know, for me, there are two ways that really work for me. One is to go sit somewhere and do nothing, and the other is in the middle of a huge anxiety attack, because I have them all the time, is to pick up my pen and be with the blank page and start moving the pen over the page, and then the thread takes me. And I've written stuff that while I was writing it, I thought, oh my God, I'm slipping into dementia. I can't be this out of control. And inevitably, I'll go back and read what I wrote during those kinds of moments, and it's the most coherent and most beautiful stuff I've written.
Very interesting. There's a quotation in one of your essays which says, barns burnt down, now I can see the moon. And just a moment ago, when you were talking about that there was a helicopter going overhead, I connected something with that quotation, and that was the days after 9/11, when there were no planes in the sky, and there was a beautiful silence here in New Mexico with no planes going over.
I love that you said that. This interview elegant for me. Thank you. About the same time the mantra came to me, I went up to Moab, Utah. I had agreed to come up and do a writing circle, and I used to have this wonderful old beat-up Nissan truck with a camper shell, so I headed up to Moab, and I took a back road and camped just off-road in a place, and it was evening, and I was sitting outside in my camp chair and just being quiet, and I suddenly realized there were no lights in the sky. There were no planes going over. I mean, there were no human lights in the sky, and it was quiet. And I just put my sleeping pad down on the ground and lay down on the ground and watched the sky. And I would alternate between terrific peace and terror because I knew what that quiet sky meant. I think I got up before dawn in the morning, and a plane went over. It was probably a military plane or something. And I had this little moment of reassurance, immediately followed by, oh, no, the noise is back. You know, that's what we're walking in now. And I don't want to give away where I live, but I need to tell this story. It's a small desert town, big military base near the desert town. And it's part of the attraction for me because the big military base means that the Red Roof Golf, you know, gated mansion developers are never going to put their stuff in there because those folks are not going to want to move to a place where at night you hear bombs because this place, the military here does practice bombing runs. And the first night I stayed in the little shack that I'm going to be staying in, I was lying in bed and it was real quiet and I heard this thud, and a bomb has just a percussive thud. The one other thing I ever heard that sounded like it was a huge piece of sandstone spalling off a cliff up in Utah. Did that boom. And I felt rounded. It was the most remarkable feeling. And I talked to a woman who works with Defenders of Wildlife in this town afterwards, and I said, it's the strangest experience because I've organized peace witnesses and, you know, done all that. And I said, that hurt when the bombs, they didn't upset me. I felt like, yeah, that's real. That's real. That's part of what we are. And it's ground. It's grounded. And she said she had exactly the same experience. And people have said to me, I can't believe you're going there. What are you going to do? Every time you're going to see a Marine, you're going to be angry. And I said, oh, honey, I would rather see 27 Marines in a tank coming down the street than see some of the people I see in Hummers and Escalades here in Flagstaff.
But there's so many levels of irony to that because you're moving to a place where people have such opposing political views to your own, and on some level, they are trying to keep America safe precisely for the Hummers and the gated communities.
Here's an interesting aspect. The actual town, the people in the actual town are completely committed. They've been there a long time. They're committed to keeping the town small, and they're committed to protecting the area around the town. And here's an irony. You want an irony?
Yes.
The military base is under stricter environmental regulations than you or me.
Really?
And that's true all over the country. And I understand what you're saying. I would venture that if you were to talk with these mostly young Marines, Marine women and men, you would discover that their experience is not at all. They don't believe for a second that they're taking care of the rich people, not for a second. And I'm not arguing with you about that. You and I know at the economic analysis that's what's happening. That's completely what's happening. But what I think we have to take another step. There's an exquisite writer and theorist named Arundhati Roy who wrote The God of Small Things, and I watched a talk that she gave to in St. John's Cathedral in New York City, which is a, you know, a good liberal Episcopalian church, I think. And she gave this talk, and she said, she gave this beautiful talk, and she was weaving together global corporations, the Bush administration, and racism. She finishes the talk, and she says, we're going to do question and answer, but you are going to want to know what you can do. And she said, the first thing you can do is look at your complicity. And she said, you can look at how your consumer habits and patterns are pouring money into the pockets of the very people who are destroying the planet. So you are part of destroying the planet. And I've had the experience, as I've given readings all through the West, mostly through the West and the Southwest, in good independent bookstores, at book festivals and writing conferences, that as long as I keep it theoretical, people are riveted. As long as I read beautiful stuff and talk about the tragedy of the horned toad and stuff, and the minute I start to look out to the audience and say, so how many vehicles do you own? So how many pairs of shoes do you own? So how many, and start talking about our consumer habits, people's faces just go blank.
Right.
And there was a beautiful piece by Rick Bass in an old Sierra magazine, and he fights for the Yaak Wilderness. I think it's in Montana, and there's lots of grizzly bears up there. So he'd gone to this very posh thing in Jackson, Wyoming, and movie stars were there, and they were fundraising for the group that was defending the grizzly bears. And he read his wonderful work. He's a wonderful writer. And in the article in Sierra Magazine, he says that while he was reading about the light shining off the hump of the grizzly bear fur, and people were riveted. And he finished his reading, and they were going to do Q&A, and he said, well, before questions and answers, I want to tell you there are postcards on all the tables, there are petitions, here are letters you can sign. And he watched in amazement as this crowd of intent, intelligent, beautifully dressed people all wandered off to the appetizer table and started talking with each other and getting drinks. And he was left standing at the podium.
Oh, my goodness.
I vividly remember going to an exquisite performance by the Gaden Shardzi Tibetan monk monastery of music and dance at our own Center for the Arts here. And the audience is loaded with people who are just dressed to the nines and wearing, you know, $10,000 Navajo silver necklaces and groovy crystals and so on and so forth. And at the end of this phenomenal performance of religious music, spiritual music and dance, this young monk got up and spoke for maybe 5 minutes, said, this is what's happening in Tibet. We ask your help. And there's a donation box out in the lobby. And my friend and I hung out till everybody had left. We walked out, and there was $15, a 10 and a 5, in that donation box. So I want to take what you said, and I want to talk about, or I want to just perhaps leave people with this question. Where is our complicity? And if you're ready to be uncomfortable, if you're ready to be as important as a horned toad or a mesquite, you know, if you're ready to have the tiniest micron of hope at a time that seems so hopeless, then you're going to be looking at your own complicity. And I think writing is a way to move into that pretty fearlessly. And once you look at your own complicity, then you're not locked off from other human beings.
Mary Sojourner, thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
It's been a gift. Thank you. It's been a refining process for me. Thank you.
Thank you. So I guess this is a good time to break because it's almost the top of the hour.
Would you like me to read one last quick little thing?
Uh-huh.
What if I read Hunting? It's really short, and it's, hold on. It's going to take me a second.
That's okay. Fine.
So this is from the essay collection, Bone Light. And I think more than anything, it sums up what I am in service to to and what has brought me to my knees and what cherishes and holds me, okay? Hunting. The trail moves through a high desert meadow. I am walking. I am hunting the glint of last light off obsidian. I carry a fossil I found at a curve in the trail, a pale sandy pebble fluted with ripples. I hold not so much an ancient sea creature as time. What I hunt is not so much stone as light. This is the magic of where I live. I reach out towards something, and what I am given is time, light. And searching the color of the southern clouds, globe mallow, fire agate, a hawk's glowing tail feathers. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Great. You want to turn off the recording and we can talk for a second?
Yeah, sure.
In that case, call me back on my cell phone.
Oh, okay. You know what? Let me do that in about 5 minutes. Is that okay?
That'll work fine.
Because my cell phone doesn't work.
I'm about a 10-minute drive from where I need to meet somebody for lunch. So.
Okay, great. I'll call you in about 5 minutes.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you. You are a kick-ass interviewer.
Oh, thank you.
You're awesome.
You're awesome.
I'm glad you're a prairie dog.
I can't wait to meet you. We'll see each other in a few days.
It's going to be so cool.
Okay. All right, bye.
Bye.